I'm Carol Hills, and you're with The World. For the past few years, if we wanted to get a global perspective on race in America, we turned to Gary Young. He's British, he's black, and for much of the past 12 years, he reported from the U.S. for The Guardian in London. Young's now moved back to Britain, but his perspective on America is as unique as ever.
People do have to wrestle with this British accent coming out of a black mouth.
Young told me about an experience he had reporting on segregation in Mississippi schools back in 1996. He started by reaching out to school administrators.
I called these principals. I started with the black principal, thinking, because I'm black myself, that, you know, maybe there might be a point of connection. And he was like, I just don't want to talk to you about this. You know, everybody's getting this wrong and I'm not interested. And then I called the white principal and he chatted for a bit and then he said, I should come over. And I came over and you could see his jaw drop because he was not expecting a black Briton. And then he introduced me to the black principal, and the black principal said, you know, I'm sorry, you know, I assumed you were white. I'm just sick of talking to white people about this. He waited for the white principal to go before he said that. I mean, there is this challenge here of being black and British, because British in the American mind, it doesn't matter how many soccer players and athletes we have, British is still understood to be a white country. And so on the one hand, you get 20 points added to your IQ because people think we British people sound more educated and more sophisticated and a bit snooty too, but nonetheless. And then comes in the blackness, which certainly, generally speaking, does not add many points to your IQ in terms of how people perceive African Americans in particular and black people in general.
Now, you spent a dozen years here, and at some point you thought this would be your permanent home. Mm. Your first child was born the year Barack Obama declared his candidacy. Did becoming a father here in the U.S. change how you looked at this country?
There was a kind of anthropological interest before. I was in Mississippi covering the Mississippi burning trial, for example, and I stopped and asked some folks for directions, and one of them said, we got a gun. And I said, okay, well, I'm looking for Rock Cut Road, so could you just tell me where Rock Cut Road was? And we gonna shoot you, we got a gun. So I jumped in my car and drove away, pretty sharpish.
Assume they were white?
They were white. And I came home, and my wife is African-American. I thought this was a funny story to tell her. And she didn't think it was funny at all. She's like, what are you doing driving around rural Mississippi asking white people for directions? And I said, well, it was in the middle of the day. And she was like, it's not funny. And then when you have kids, you have skin in the game, and it's black skin in a game that doesn't really favor black skin.
There's more at stake.
And it's no longer anthropology, it's your life.
Looking back at your years here, what conclusions did you draw about American identity and how the descendants of immigrants, all of us really, became so xenophobic? I mean, did you end up with any kind of answer or explanation?
Certainly not an answer. No, I didn't come up with an answer. But unlike in Europe, Americans love immigration. Class fluidity, reinvention, optimism, all of those things are central to the American myth, and immigration can be part of them. In a way that in Europe, people are often reflexively hostile to the notion of immigration. While Americans love immigration, they don't necessarily love immigrants. I went to a Minuteman rally in Arizona, and after, you know, breathing fire about immigration and closing the border and all that kind of stuff, in ways that I would be very familiar with in Britain, with UKIP or France and Front National or most of Europe, the man then turned to this woman, a white woman who had come from the Ukraine, and said, this woman just got her papers last week, and everybody cheered. And he said, she did it the right way. And so that notion that
there's a right way and a wrong way.
There's a right way and a wrong way. And the wrong way, the borders of who is wrong and why they're wrong shift. But the notion that there is a wrong way remains constant. And sometimes it's because it's the wrong people, or sometimes it's about how they came in, or it's their religion, or whatever it is. But this notion that there might also be a right way, which you wouldn't find anybody in the Front National talking in that way.
What went into your decision to leave?
It was a series of very banal issues. My wife is American. We were living in New York. New York is a very difficult place to live with a child.
But was it also a conscious decision that you didn't want to raise your kids here?
that's not what prompted me to leave, but it's why, once we'd made the decision to leave, that is certainly why I never revisited that decision or never regretted it. Everywhere has racism of some kind against somebody. The difference here, the distinction, I think, is that American racism, because of other things, is more lethal.
Just simply access to guns.
Access to guns, the prevalence of shootings, the snow melts in Chicago and a gun shows up just behind the park and my wife is bobbing my daughter to sleep in a carrier on the way to Target and a gunfight breaks out. There's a range of lethal opportunities in America that just don't exist anywhere else in the Western world. When we were back in Britain, we went to visit a friend in Yorkshire whose son was really into toy guns. So my son and my friend's son went running out into the hills with these toy guns. And my wife, who's American, turned to me and said, "Are we comfortable with that?" And I thought about it for a second and I said, "Yeah, because everyone will know they are toy guns because nobody here is packing." I mean, we would not let that happen in America. Without that, there we would put our foot down because that, you know, that's how Tamir Rice got shot, and it's not difficult to predict what might happen. So
he was the young child who was brandishing a weapon.
A toy gun
after
in Cleveland.
In Cleveland.
Yeah.
My final question is about a new book you're working on.
It starts with the statistic that every day, on average, 7 children are shot dead in America. So I picked a day at random, which was November the 23rd, 2013. And I found out as many of the children who were shot dead that day as I could. There were 10 on that day.
These are kids under 18?
19 and under. So most of these kids die with a paragraph or two. And I set out trying to find out who they were, what they wanted to be, and what was the context in which they died. And they died all over America.
A book you wouldn't be able to write in the UK, I don't think.
It's a book that you wouldn't be able to write anywhere else in the Western world. For Britain to have that proportionate number of children die, of 7, not the 10, it would take 10 weeks, not one day. And interestingly, while I was back, when I'd been back maybe 3 weeks in The Guardian, and there was a story of a boy who'd been killed in a knife attack. It was thought to be gang-related. And my colleague at The Guardian, appalled, said, "This is the 7th child to have been killed in a gang-related attack in the country this year." And I, coming from Chicago, I thought, wow. I mean, in Chicago, that's a bad holiday weekend.
Gary Young is the author of 4 books, most recently The Speech, the story behind Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s dream. Thank you, Gary.
Thank you.